Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Progressives were holding their breath during President Obama's State of the Union address Tuesday evening, hoping not to hear any mention of the Keystone XL pipeline or the fast-track approval option for the dreadful Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Treaty. They didn't hear either of those, but I was dumbfounded that what barely got mentioned was the global climate disruption, the planetary crisis of extreme weather we've all entered, regardless of political persuasion or personal net worth. As you no doubt know, the Kyoto Protocol's pretty much petered out and have been replaced by the utterly maddening annual conferences of their parent organization, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. But back when the United Nations Conference was held in Kyoto in 1997 for the purpose of framing a global agreement to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, there was considerable momentum and there was a lot of hope. I've seen a couple of articles recently noting that the 15 lost years of serious climate action compared to what could have happened is really tied to the way that process was derailed, and that's true, but it's not widely known, or not widely enough in my view, what happened there, because it's still happening. And that was that at the Kyoto conference, as many, many people told me, I had many friends who were there with different NGOs, the planes that landed disgorged scores and scores and hundreds of lobbyists from the fossil fuel corporations, each assigned to a certain delegate from the so-called developing world. And when it was time to get close to signing, finishing the negotiations, signing the agreement, they just hammered in, and I'm not sure there weren't incentives involved, but the fact that the, quote, developing, unquote, world should take a stance and say, hey, wait a minute, it's our turn. The lobbyists kept saying, it's your turn to get rich. These people have all gotten rich off industrialized cultures, and now they just want to hold you back, but it's your turn to get up there and grab it for yourself. So they said, you're just being victimized and sacrificed here, and all you want is what they have, and that's just perfectly just and reasonable, so don't sign this thing. And that's exactly what happened. These delegates from all these capital cities throughout the South were perfectly intelligent people, and that's why I would not be surprised if there were incentives offered if they went along with this, because they could see what was happening. But now you see these references saying, oh, gee, we've lost all this time, even though some countries did sign. And one of the articles I saw last week said, you know, it was a mistake to something like allow the developing countries not to sign, by which I hope he meant we should have talked to them and negotiated and say, what would you want? Would you want technology transfer? Would you want help getting solar panels on every government building to start with, and then residences? Would you want, you know, different kind of help like that? But that wasn't done, and so the lobbyists carried the day. Anyway, the Kyoto Protocol was adopted on December 11th, 1997, by some countries and not others, of course not us. President George W. Bush said, oh, no, we wouldn't want to go there. And it went into force for the signatories on February 16th, 2005, and this started the first what they call commitment period, which was going to be counted from 2008 to 2012, during which 37 industrialized countries of the European community and others did commit to reducing the level of their emissions of six greenhouse gases to 5.2% below what the 1990 levels had been. And it was very dispiriting on that day that our country wasn't part of that effort. We were far into the crisis by then, and our only hope was to stop it from getting worse. It couldn't be reversed at that point. Compared to where we are now, oh, even worse. But so actually, that same year, 2005, was the year that Vice President Cheney intensified the extraction of oil and gas in our country by slipping in to the infamous Energy Act of 2005, that little paragraph, little section, which became known as the Halliburton loophole. It's a simple sentence that no one paid much attention to that stated that the extraction method known as hydraulic fracturing was henceforth no longer under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Clean Water Act. And that unleashed the boom in fracking with all its toxic chemicals. Well, in any event, that hadn't happened yet in February 16th, 2005, when the Kyoto Protocol went to effect, into effect elsewhere in the world. But on that very day, the mayor of Seattle, Greg Nickels, who was then heading the U.S. Conference on Mayors, launched the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement and said they're not going to wait for the national government to act, that they were going to act and do the right thing and make a commitment to try to reduce their level of greenhouse gas emissions in every city that participated in the agreement. And they were also going to lobby county, state, and national governments to pass serious legislation and also make a serious effort to do this. So they approved it officially at their annual meeting in June. That time, I think about 140 mayors signed on. Last time I looked, a couple years ago, it was over 1,000. And I'm sure it's been beaten back by the long arm of the fossil fuel corporations in various ways. But they did achieve, that group, the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Program from the federal government, which made it possible for the first time in U.S. history for cities and counties and states to receive grants specifically to fund energy efficiency projects. So just hearing about this on that launch day of the Kyoto Protocols in February 2005, that the mayors were going to take this initiative, it just made me feel so hopeful that something could still happen in the right direction. And then a few months later, something else happened that focused my attention on the initiatives being taken by mayors and to good effect. On June 5th of that year, 2005, the United Nations Environment Program sponsored its annual World Environment Day, and for the first time it was held in the United States. The theme that year was Green Cities, and the host city was San Francisco. So mayors from what were described in the press release as 50 of the largest and most visionary cities on the planet came together, and after previous negotiation with their staffs working together, signed the Urban Environmental Accords, a document that sets out 21 specific actions for sustainable urban living. It addressed areas of water, energy, waste, urban design, transportation, urban nature, and environmental health. And what it said was, you know, we commit ourselves to moving vital issues of sustainability to the top of our legislative agendas, something we were certainly not hearing from national governments, at least not ours. So I was a participant in a small way at that Global Green Cities Conference because the Green Institute, at which I was a senior fellow, held a reception, and I got to attend several of the sessions of the conference. The one that was utterly memorable for me and very exciting took place in a large room filled with staff people of municipal governments from around the world, and they took turns telling us about various innovative programs and actions that their city had successfully adopted. Very interesting, creative, original, pragmatic thinking. And someone was, of course, recording this outflow of wise and effective ideas on butcher paper taped to the walls. And the cumulative effect was really so inspiring and energizing. It was really great to see what's possible and what's happening with initiative from the local level. So I wondered that day, and since then, if there are horizontal lines of communication and networking among all these innovative city governments and their local NGOs. And it turns out that there certainly are. But the person we'll hear from momentarily has a vision for mayors and cities that goes far beyond my wondering about whether they were networked. My guest today is Benjamin R. Barber, author of 17 books, including Strong Democracy, and then Jihad versus McWorld, and then Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. And his latest book, which we'll be hearing about today, is If Mayors Ruled the World, Dysfunctional Nations, Rising Cities. Benjamin Barber is a senior research scholar at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. He's the founder of the Interdependence Movement, and he is Walt Whitman Professor Emeritus at Rutgers University. He appears frequently in domestic and international media and consults regularly with political and civic leaders here and abroad. He writes and speaks on a wide variety of questions connected to democracy and citizenship, including the arts, education, globalization, terrorism, and the new politics of the Middle East and North Africa. Benjamin Barber, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Charlene.
Well, you've written about a number of areas, and I'm wondering, how did you become interested in focusing on cities?
Well, I think like all of us in the progressive movement, the central trope, the central concern is democracy, self-government, and the liberty and justice and social equality and opportunity that go with a self-governing democratic society. And I've been writing for 50 years about democracy, democracy in Switzerland, democracy in the United States, participatory democracy, democracy in its relationship to capitalism and commercialism and consumer society, democracy when it's squeezed between the forces of aggressive global capitalism and the forces of reactionary tribalism and jihad in Jihad versus the World, and increasingly getting, I'm afraid, more and more pessimistic, because though I'm an optimistic sort and believe deeply in the human potential for self-legislation and self-government, I believe all human beings are capable and educated and trained, are capable of governing themselves. The fact is, we live in a world where even in the so-called democracies, there's increasing cynicism and pessimism about the possibilities of democracy. In the developing and emerging world, we see places that try democracy or what they think is democracy and then get fed up with it. We see the confusion between democracy and capitalism. If you've got a free market society, you're supposedly democratic and so forth. So things have been getting more and more pessimistic. And what happened in recent years is that as part of my work in the interdependence movement, I have been noticing, because we meet annually in a global city for the last 10 years, since 12 years, since 9/11, I've been noticing that it's in cities that, as your piece about climate change made clear, in cities that progressive policies are still being pursued, in cities that citizens still have a relative trust and faith in democratic governance, in cities that people are trying to actually implement policies that make a difference, whether with respect to immigration or climate change or gun control or other issues that we all care about. In other words, what I'm noticing is that after 400 years of the sovereign nation state, we are beginning to go back to what was there before nation states, cities, the polis, and re-looking at the possibilities of local and municipal government. And when we do that, as your piece made clear, suddenly some of the things that look so grim, so foreboding, open up and look like maybe there's a chance for real movement.
Well, I was intrigued by the fact that you open your book with this chapter that says, you know, if mayors rule the world, why they should and how they already do. Could you tell the listeners about that?
Sure, and it's interesting that you said, Charlie, you know, in looking at what cities were doing in the area of climate change, you know, both one by one, but also together, that it came to your attention that there were, in fact, some inner city global trans- border organizations and associations doing work. And the reality is, if you talk to high school kids or any American citizen with any relative knowledge and say, what was the League of Nations, what is the United Nations, what's the Bretton Woods Institutions, what's the World Bank, the IMF, they'll all say, oh, yeah, yeah, you know, they'll know what it is. But if you ask them, what's the UCLG, United Cities and Local Governments? What's ICLE, the International Environmental Issue, the Intercity Cooperative League? What's CityNet, the Asian Network of Cities? What's City Protocol, a global virtual network of cities sharing best practices on the web? You know, people would just throw up their hands and say, what? Mm-hmm. Excuse me? Huh? Never heard of it. I like to call United Cities and Local Governments, an organization of over 3,000 cities that meets annually to share best practices, the most important organization in the world nobody's ever heard of. You know, and so that we have this panoply of civic and intercity cooperative organizations where cities are not just one by one trying to deal with issues of immigration and climate change and gun control and transportation and sea rise, but are also trying to do it together, not just through the old sister cities, you know, cosmetic kind of, let's take a tour of Paris because New York and Paris are sister cities, but cities that have shared ground, shared challenges, shared common interest, and a shared sense of how you go about dealing with those problems. And in fact, there are a lot of international intercity associations, not enough. And the last chapter of my book actually proposes a global parliament of mayors, in other words, a kind of equivalent of the UN assembly for cities, where mm-hmm. cities would meet regularly and mayors would have a megaphone in front of their voices and could put forward urban interests. Because the bottom line for me is that if you care about, as we progressives do, if you care about the public good, the res publica, shared ground, the commonwealth, although all of those terms refer to public interests, cities, more than any other political entities, are all about the public interest. And when cities speak together globally, you get something like a representation of the global common interest, the global commons, the global public good. And in a world where we know here in the United States and increasingly in other countries, there is a kind of war, not just on big government and bureaucracy, but on a war on the very idea of the public interest, of the commons, of shared responsibility, an entity like the city that stands for the commons, for public ground, and for shared goods, and for public goods, becomes mm-hmm. so important to our cause.
Since you mentioned best practices, I want to make sure that the listeners know, on the website for the U.S. Conference of Mayors, there's a tab that says best practices. And you can go there, and there's a search box, and you can type in anything like gun violence, and up will pop all these articles about solutions that different municipal governments and their civic organizations working together have figured out and put into place and what their effect has been. So if you're a member of a community group like that or talking to your city government, make sure that everyone in your group knows about that. It's a great resource. Anyway, let me ask you, in addition to putting out your argument here, you interview several mayors from around the world, and a couple of them in particular, I mean, they're all effective, but a couple of them had a very democratic vision of what they're doing in that seat, maybe Stuttgart and Seoul. I mean, they said, well, the people are the mayor, you know. Can you say something about that model?
Well, that's really important, Charlene, because one of the things that is really undermining democracy today is if you look at the trust levels of the American people, and this, by the way, is reproduced in other countries as well, with respect to their national governments, it's very low. We know that President Obama, you know, for all kinds of reasons that aren't always his fault, but nonetheless, the presidency in President Obama is around 38% or 40%. The Supreme Court, which used to be in the 70s, is down in the 40s. Congress, elected by the American people, is 8% trust levels. 92% of Americans don't trust the very Congress that they've elected, you know, to do their jobs. But when it comes to cities, city councilors and mayors, trust levels, belief levels are up at 70% and 80% still. So we still trust our local officials because we see them as neighbors in power. We see them as neighbors taking time to take some responsibility. We see them as really belonging to us. It's very hard to make the Tea Party case, the Ayn Rand case of big government, alien government taking over our liberties in the city, because in the city it's very clear how the mayor and the council and the things the mayor and the city government does does are in our interest, that really serve, whether it's plowing the snow or having sewers or helping with job programs or preschool programs of the kind that de Blasio now wants to try to put in place in New York. The things mayors do aren't big government getting in the way of our liberty, in the mischaracterization that the right makes of government. It's really about what democratic government is. It's us doing things together that we can't do alone to solve problems. And mayors are really good at that. And what happens, and what I found really interestingly, is that around the world, an awful lot of mayors don't care to be identified by right and left, by, you know, their party labels, because they really see their job as solving problems, getting things done. Mayor Nutter of Philadelphia said recently, we could never get away with the crap that they get away with up in Washington because, you know, we got to keep the city running. Mm-hmm. I mean, the amazing thing was last fall, you know, they closed the U.S. government. Now, you and I know, and progressives know, a lot of people got hurt. But the amazing thing is they closed down the U.S. government and a lot of people didn't even notice. But you try to close Boston, you close Cincinnati, you close mm-hmm. San Francisco. You can't mm-hmm. close a city. What, no cops, no police, mm-hmm. no firemen, no schools, no hospitals, no subways, no buses? You know, you can't do it. You can't close cities. And mm-hmm. mayors know that. So they don't have the luxury of a big-time stand on principle. We don't believe in taxation, so we're not going to let government do anything. No mayor can get away with that. They have to be problem solvers. They have to be pragmatists. They've got to actually fix things and make things happen. And that's right. not done in the name of progressivism, but in fact it no. suits and accommodates progressive principles because it serves the needs of people.
Right. Well, I agree in general. I did happen to see Rachel Maddow's feature last night on the corruption in New York City, people getting arrested in 4 out of 5 boroughs on one day. So, but in general, of course, there is a higher trust level locally.
Well, generally, by the way, I'm not arguing. I just want to be clear. I'm not arguing that vice stops at the door of City Hall.
No, but I want to ask you about this because corruption is a matter of money. And the problem with our national government, of course, is that every vote in Washington is bought because of the electoral system. They have to curry favor from the big donors, whether corporate or the rich people. So that's why we have the kind of tax structure we have. That's why Social Security tax isn't applied equally to all earners, all of everybody's earned income. So if we sort of move the focus more, and whether we move it or not, as you say, it's happening to cities, I just wonder if the corporate forces won't force some, quote, pragmatic decisions on the part of mayors. For instance, you know, people are very scared about their jobs, and a corporate squeeze, the big employers in a city, could, you know, skew things in their direction away from the people's interest, or at least their employees' interest, to a certain extent. Do you think?
Well, a couple things. One, you know, corruption is always caught at the level of the city, partly because cities are more transparent, partly because of small-time corruption. You know, in Washington, big-time corruption is called politics as usual. You know, I mean, the money is out there influencing national government all the time. We know the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, is actually an organization of corporations that goes about its business by writing legislation for state legislators throughout the nation.
Right.
They literally write it, and then often it's put word to word into practice, but the voters don't know that
right.
these rather highly technical pro-corporate policies have actually been written by the corporations for state legislators who are paid sums to do that. That's much worse than corruption. That's a fundamental undermining of democratic government.
And
but
that couldn't happen at a city level?
And of course, it could happen anywhere. So, but what I want to say is that we tend to notice it, and people get caught when they do it at the local level. We laugh about Rob Ford, you know, on dope and on coke and so on, doing it and so forth. But far more dangerous than coke to governance is big money, you know, which is an invisible kind of addiction that can truly undermine. So that's, but here's the second thing, because your real question is, okay, but money is everywhere, corporate power is everywhere, big capitalism is everywhere. Are cities in any better position to counter than others? And the answer is partly, of course not. One of the deep problems that progressives like de Blasio face is they are trying to take on the challenge of inequality when they don't control the origins of that inequality. The fundamental inequalities of the American system that so many American cities suffer from and other cities around the world grows out of the inequalities of the infrastructure of global capitalism and global markets in a system that produces wealth very well and doesn't distribute wealth very well, that is very good at distributing and commodities but not very good at creating jobs and so forth. And that's a problem that no mayor of a city can deal with directly because he's not in a position, she's not in a position to deal with the fundamental inequalities of the capitalist system. They only have to deal with the consequences. But the reality is, and here's what's
interesting. But they got worse over 30 years.
They've got much worse for the whole country.
For the rich. Could a municipal government counter that?
But here's the difference. Mayors can and are doing something about it, even though they can't deal with the causes. And there are a lot of ways in which mayors are dealing with it. And De Blasio chose two areas, really important areas. He knows that given the inequalities of the capitalist system, education is crucial to getting ahead with what jobs there are and overcoming some of the inequalities there, and that preschool education, there's no one who denies the fact that preschool education is absolutely vital to later educational opportunities. So de Blasio is saying we have to have a couple of years of preschool ed for every child in New York, and we have to figure out a way to fund it, and I'm going to do that. I'm going to make that happen. Second area, affordable housing. I mean, if people are going to live in cities and try to compete for jobs and maybe get new skills and fight to get a better wage, they've obviously got to have a decent place to live that doesn't bankrupt them. And we know from that remarkable story of Dasani a month ago or so in the New York Times, a young, beautiful 12-year-old black girl who was living for 2.5 years in a homeless shelter intended for no more than 2 weeks' residence.
Mm-hmm.
And there are over 50,000 families in New York living in homeless shelters for years at a time, and they were only supposed to be there. They were designed to hold them for 2 weeks because there's no affordable housing to move into. So a second move of the de Blasio administration is that we've got to get more affordable housing. The previous mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, was very good at, empowering developers to build business skyscrapers and corporate buildings and new condos for the rich from around the world. But he didn't ask anything of the development corporations. He didn't say, you can have a high-rise building over here on 57th Street, but we want you to build 600 units of affordable housing at the same time. And that's the condition for doing business in New York.
Right.
And, of course, the corporations say, we won't build here. And say, don't. There's plenty of others who want to. Everyone wants to build in New York. So, what de Blasio is doing is asking the people who make over $500,000 to put up $1,000 or so for preschool education. The big development corporation, sure, go on doing your developments here, but pay a price to make it a healthier, more egalitarian city. That will serve working people and poor people. By the way, it will serve you, too, because it will make New York a more desirable place for everybody to live.
That's right. We're going to have to pause here for the break, but I want to say first, in addition to housing and education, which are so important, we need to correct the wages because over the last 30 years, as the productivity and the profits grew, the wages didn't grow. And there started to be business articles in the late 1990s saying, this is strange. They're not increasing wages. The wages are not expanding as the profits are. So there's been, a big hijacking of people's actual earned income, and wages everywhere need to be corrected to counter what was quite purposely done over the last 30 years. Talk about takers. They really took the earnings from the people who were doing the work. Okay, we will pause here for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Benjamin Barber, author of If Mayors Ruled the World. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Benjamin Barber, author of If Mayors Ruled the World. So there are so many interesting things in this book I want to ask you about, but I want to make sure we don't run out of time before we get to your big idea. So let's jump ahead and then I'll double back. Could you tell us, what would this global parliament of mayors look like? How would it work?
I will. Let me just say one word, because you made such an important point before the break about wages, and then we were talking about housing and education, and wages are equally important. But here's the great thing about cities. there's nothing to stop mayors, as some states have actually done, establishing their own minimum wage. They don't have to wait for Congress. They can say $10.10 an hour starting today, and they don't just do it for their municipal workers, who actually are getting a lot more than $10.10 an hour for the most part. They can say any contracting company that wants to work with the city, have a contract with the city and take taxpayer dollars, has to pay minimum wage at least to their workers. And in doing that, they can have a profound effect. Keep in mind, 78% of Americans live in cities. And for every city in America to have a minimum wage, we'd have, you know, nearly three-quarters of the working force covered by minimum wage. So there are real things that cities can do without waiting around for states or the national government to do things, and in the wage area is one of them. But let's come
And many mayors have supported the living wage, you know, which for their area might be higher than what people are talking about for even an increased minimum wage, and they've really gotten behind that, I've seen.
You're right, and then, by the way, it's kind of a joke that we go to 10-10 and say, you know, that's the minimum wage. It sure is minimum. I mean, try to live that with a family of four.
Exactly.
And so on. So a living wage is a lot better bet. But at least the point is you can at least set a standard that says cities don't have to wait for the national government to take action here. And the mayor's parliament idea comes out of that, because what we are finding, whether it's in climate change, which is where your piece opened, and I want to say a word about what cities are doing together on climate change, because you alluded to it, but they're doing some very important things without the nation state that they're part of doing anything at all. But what the idea is that when cities work together in an interdependent world where boundaries, sovereign national frontiers are no longer relevant, a world of global climate change, global technology, global immigration, global markets, global terrorism, global pandemics. Now, that's the world we live in, and we still address all these global interdependent problems with a 17th century set of institutions, sovereign, bordered nation states that don't cooperate. And that's crazy. You know, that asymmetry explains why the planet's kind of out of control. And it's clear that nations, rooted in their sovereignty and their rival interests and the vetoes at the United Nations, are unlikely to be able to do very much together. They proved it, as you said, at Copenhagen and in all of the annual meetings since then. But cities don't have to wait any more than they have to wait for a minimum wage. They can move ahead through inner-city associations and cooperation. And we started by saying there are already a lot of inner-city associations, but what we don't have is a genuinely global association of cities, of mayors, that allow cities to meet together on a regular basis, to hold a megaphone up in front of the voice of cities, the public interest of cities, so the world's population can get a feel for the way in which cities really represent where they are. I mean, a couple of facts about cities people don't know. A couple of years ago, 50% of the world, for the first time in history, live in cities. Mm-hmm. In the developed world, it's 78%. 80% of global GDP comes from cities. 81% of carbon emissions and greenhouse gases come from cities, which means they're in a position to do something about 80% of carbon emissions. 90% of cities are built on water, where ocean rise, whether it's rivers or lakes, take place. So cities are poised demographically and in terms of all the issues of the interdependent 21st century world to do things together to solve problems. And the inner city associations we have are a good start. But what I'm calling for is literally a global assembly of cities, a United Cities International, a group of cities that come together on a regular basis, not just to share best practices, but to discuss. Let's just say the city's parliament was to say, we want a world minimum wage, not just an American minimum wage. We want a world emissions standard. We want a world ban on fracking, and we represent 52% of the world's population, and in the Western world, 80% of the world's population. They would be in a position, they can't mandate that, they can't tell nation states what to do, but it would have a powerful impact on the political and policy decisions of those nation states. So allowing cities to gather their mayors to represent the public and common interests of cities around the world would put us in a position to have the most progressive and liberal and public forces in the world today, speaking with one voice about what needs to be done to create a sustainable planet, a sustainable economy, and a just and peaceful world.
And you talked about regional, that maybe delegates would come from cities and their region, and maybe the people who live out in the region would only vote on certain things. I mean, I bring that up because all the way through the book, you know, I was, well, I understand you're a native of New York City. I read in some bio piece somewhere you were born in New York and I guess have raised there. And I'm someone who likes to visit cities, but the thought of living in one is just so unappealing. And it just seemed that in the book, you know, you set up these poles, the countryside and the city, but it's really so varied. There are towns of 10,000, 20,000. There are a lot of cultured people in them. You know, maybe they're an hour from some big city. And there's a lot going on there that's very vital and interesting.
No question. You're right. Look, let me say something.
You were saying we need a dialectical between country and city, but maybe a multilectical, because it's a very complex situation of who lives in all the land between the cities.
My family's from Mason City, Iowa. My first cousin was Meredith Wilson, who wrote The Music Man. I went to Grinnell College in Iowa. Okay, so I know
that you
heartland.
Went to Grinnell, but you weren't born in New York.
I was born in New York. Yeah, but all I'm saying is, I love the heartland of America. I have Midwest roots. I love that. This isn't an argument that cities are going to rule the world. Ed Glaser has said that we're kind of an urban species, and there's no question from the beginning of time we tend to press into townships, villages, polises, and cities because we like the density, we like the friction, we like to be up against one another. And while there are a few rustic souls who want to be in the prairie by themselves or in a mountain by themselves, even as you say in the countryside, even in Kansas, people don't know, 52% of people in Kansas live in towns over 10,000. You know, so even in, you know, Red Kansas and Prairie Kansas and Wizard of Oz, Kansas, we tend to live together. The representational organization I'm thinking of is going to have three tranches of representation, one for cities 5,000 to 500,000, one 500,000 to 5 million, and one tranche of 5 million to 30 million. So you're going to get that. Second is that, you know, the political question is always as compared to what? Right now, the problem we face in the United States and in Holland and in many parts of the world is not that city populations are a tyranny of the majority over the poor, misunderstood rural backwaters. It's that the rural backwaters dominate the national system. A tiny minority of the Republican Party, the Tea Party, mostly rural, in fact is dominating the politics of the United States and silencing the vast urban majority and forcing policies down their throats that they don't want or like. The time may come.
But the House is based on population. House of Representatives?
Excuse me, it's based on population jerry-rigged, gerrymandered,
so that it takes
56 or 57% of the vote to get only half the House, which is the only reason that the Republicans still are controlling and will probably continue to control the House. So the fact that the Senate,
that's
as you know,
a fixable problem.
And the Senate goes in the other direction. So what I'm saying right now, the problem is not that rural America is underrepresented. That problem may come one day. Second of all, there's nothing to stop someone from writing a book called If Prairies Ruled the World, you know.
But that's my point. There's a
and
prairies.
Let them do
it's
that.
Like, you're
but right
going
now,
to the other
but
extreme.
Right now, I'm not concerned with urban, rural. I'm concerned with public, private. And the fact is the public interest, public goods, common space are represented in cities, not in the country, not in the suburbs. If you're looking for a voice that speaks to progress, to justice, to peace, it's the urban voice. It's very interesting. In the 19th and early 20th century, the national government stood for civil rights and universal values against the parochial states and cities. But today, if you want to speak, find a voice that speaks for dealing with climate change, dealing with gay rights, dealing with issues of gender, dealing with race, the cities, the so-called parochial cities, are in the progressive majority.
Yeah, far
and the
ahead
national
of the state
government,
legislature. Yeah.
And the national government drags behind, frankly.
That's right.
So, you know, even in those terms, so it's not really about, oh, I don't care what city people vote for. They live in cities. I was born in New York, so let's let New York rule the world. I'm not Mayor Bloomberg trying to suggest that, you know, just because I was born in New York and so Manhattan, you know, Manhattan overall. What I have noticed about cities is that cities stand deeply for common goods for public interest. That's why they are on the side of curbing carbon emissions. That's why they are on the side of rights for all people. That's why they are the side of economic equality for all, educational opportunity for all. They stand for the things I care about, and of course there are plenty of people who live in the countryside who also are progressives and care about those things.
And there are plenty of cities, you know, you were talking about before how it took the federal government to trump the druthers of cities and states on segregation. So
once
there are still cities throughout the South that wouldn't share those values you mentioned.
Well, but I guess the argument I'm making in the book is that nowadays that valence has really been reversed, and that in fact, in general, of course, there are always exceptions, but in general, whether in Europe or Asia or Africa or Latin America, it's the cities and towns. And by the way, it is cities and towns. I really including towns, 5, 10, 15, 25,000.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, they're well represented in the mayor's parliament. And, you know, what I'm talking about, and there are...
Okay,
know,
now I feel better.
No, that's... I mean, and by the way, I spent half of my year in Richmond, Massachusetts, where Deval Patrick also has a home. And I was brought up there, and the Berkshires are a relatively sophisticated cosmopolitan, but very rural. If you like, part of
right.
Massachusetts.
Yeah, that's a good example.
So it's, you know, I'm not by any means trying to, you know, pound the notion.
No, I'm just trying to figure out where they would fit in. Places like that would fit into the scheme.
Well, they would literally have their own tranche of seats. That, you know,
right.
For towns from 5,000 to 500,000 would have, you know, seats reserved for them. So that it would, and that in a sense is not really the popular majority, because obviously the mega cities are the popular majority, but that doesn't matter, because I completely agree with you that if small towns and smaller cities are not represented, you are going to, you know, really lose an awful lot of the quality of cosmopolitan life and progressive life. By the way, also, and the other thing is, and you pointed to it in the beginning, we're not talking about cities defined by their 19th century boundaries. We're talking about greater metropolitan regions.
Uh-huh.
And to some extent, if you take the eastern and western seaboard, that's all city. You know, from Richmond, Virginia, up to Boston and Portland, Maine. I mean, we're talking about greater metropolitan regions that include suburbs and country areas and the Hudson farmlands that serve local agriculture in New York and so forth. And you're really talking about peoples from those regions. And one of the problems today is that cities often serve in their services large metropolitan regions that don't pay taxes, that don't, you know, pay back anything in return. There's 10 counties around Detroit.
Yeah,
which make up the greater Detroit metropolitan region, have grown from 3 to 5 million people and are one of the most prosperous areas of the United States, at the same time that old-fashioned downtown Detroit has gone bankrupt and gone from 2 million to 700,000 people. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, when I'm talking about Detroit, I mean the greater Detroit metropolitan region, which is a much, much larger area. So, yes, I mean, your questions are really good and important, but if you look at the book, you'll see I do understand that you can't just say, let's take downtown Los Angeles and Manhattan and, you know, the area around Boston Common and Beacon Hill and say, let them rule the world. I mean, that would be absurd.
Yeah, no, it's such a strong argument all the way through, Valentine, to cities, and the examples you give usually are big cities. So, you know, I see the 5 to 10,000 range would have their, as you say, level at this World Parliament. Since it went to the book went to press, I imagine you've been continuing to work on this idea. Have you gotten interest in this Parliament
idea?
Well,
what has been stunning to me is that what was an idea in the book, you know, last summer, now has drawn the attention of mayors from 3 dozen cities. I've been invited to Seoul, Korea by Wonsan Park for a meeting there with CityNet, the Asian cities. I've been invited to Amsterdam by Mayor Van de Laan to hold a meeting there. Boris Johnson has expressed interest. Mayor Garcetti, of the new mayor of Los Angeles, has expressed interest. I've had talks with Bloomberg and Boris Johnson in London. Mayor Wolfgang Schuster, 16 years mayor of Stuttgart. Mayor Olaf Scholz of Hamburg. There are most cities everywhere are interested, not because it's a fascinating theoretical dream, but because they understand that in the modern interdependent world, cities have to cooperate. They mm-hmm. have to work together to do their own tasks. What mayors say to me again and again is, I don't want to rule the world. I'm too busy ruling my own city. I can hardly do that. But if cooperation and working together with other cities helps me govern my city, I need and want to do that. And what they've been persuaded of, not by me, but by the realities of the interdependent economy and interdependent immigration and trade and global climate change and global pandemics and terrorism, is that you can't govern the world city by city or state by state. You have to do it interdependently. I think there's a phrase I rather like, which says, all together now. And what cities are saying is, all together now. You know, we can't do this one by one, and we need organizations and associations to cooperate because it's a heavy lift, and we have to do that lifting together. And the example, maybe just coming full circle back to where you started with climate change, is that, as you pointed out, not only did a number of cities back in 2005 get on board, but in the Copenhagen meeting that started the recent 4 or 5 years trying to renegotiate a better Kyoto Protocol without success, the mayor of Copenhagen, who had been environmental minister of Denmark and went back to be the mayor of Copenhagen again because she thought, I actually have more power in Copenhagen than I had in the environmental ministry and the national government, she invited several hundred mayors to the Copenhagen meeting. And after the 2 weeks when the 184 nations went home, and you described that so nicely in your opening piece, that they went home, they said, we can't do anything, our sovereignty doesn't allow us to monitor or do anything, we're not in a position, the corporations, the carbon corporations, the carbon industry is controlling us, the mayors stayed. And since then, the mayors have been working. First of all, there's an organization called the C40, which Bloomberg and Bill Clinton and Bill Gates and others have been involved in starting. It's an organization now of about 60 large cities that have pledged to common standards on emissions, to common insulation standards, and so forth, and to work together. But way before that, there was an organization called ICLEI, I-C-L-E-I, which is the International Council of Environmental Issues for Local Government, and that group has been working for a long time to work together. And what's interesting is if you look at different cities, if you look at Los Angeles, for example, when Mayor Villaraigosa, who just finished his term last year, was mayor, he came into Los Angeles and he saw that the carbon emissions, the greenhouse gases, were horrendously high, and something had to be done.
We're going to have to finish up here. But...
okay, let me just say, he greened up the port. He greened up the port. New York, they improved insulation standards. Bogota got a new surface transportation system. So cities, one by one and together, and we all know about bike share programs and pedestrian zones.
No,
those
there are a
things
lot of great,
that cities are doing together.
Green city examples.
So we can, all together now, cities can do things that nations won't and can't.
And I just want to make sure people know that this book, If Mayors Rule the World, it's very information-rich, which I love, and it has charts and tables. He lists all these existing networks, so it's really a great resource if you're working in this area at all. Okay, well, that's all the time we have. Benjamin Barber, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Charlene, very much for a very invigorating show.
Well, let's move over to the Arts Corner now. Since we've been hearing about cities today, I'm going to read a paragraph that the great abstract painter Vasily Kandinsky wrote in 1913 about his feelings for Moscow, which were mingled with his loving feelings for his mother. This is from his book entitled Reminiscences. My mother is a born Moscovite, and unites in herself the qualities which to me symbolize Moscow: external striking beauty, serious and strict through and through, aristocratic simplicity, inexhaustible energy, a unique union of tradition with true free thinking, woven out of great nervousness, imposing majestic calm and heroic self-mastery. In sum, the white stone, gold-headed Mother Moscow, in human form. Moscow, two-sided, complexity, intense movement, collisions and confusion in outward appearance, which ultimately forms an individual unitary image. This totality of the outer and inner Moscow, I believe to be the origins of my artistic endeavors. For our song today, well, it's midwinter. So that means that a lot of people in the northern part of our country are suffering from seasonal affective disorder, a condition in which the scant amount of sunlight on short, overcast winter days affects some people biologically in very debilitating ways. Around this time last year, I saw an article stating that the two geographic areas with the highest incidence of seasonal affective disorder every winter are the Pacific Northwest and New England, which made me wonder why the upper Midwest wouldn't be one of those high incidence areas. What with all those relentless gray days and the wind blasting down from the Arctic. But then I realized they are probably protected from seasonal affective disorder by a particular cultural practice they have there. And that practice is the polka. So for our annual therapeutic musical treatment for SAD, we'll hear the classic Beer Barrel Polka. Grab a partner or dance around the house by yourself. You'll feel so much better. This is Frankie Yankovic and his Yanks. Here it is. Frankie Yankovic with the Beer Barrel Polka. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest, Zainab Ton, a professor at MIT who is the author of a new book, The Good Job Strategy. I'll be back 2 weeks from today on February 13th. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now. Now that we know it, let's